Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the podcast. Today we have a very exciting guest in Michelle Kelly. Michelle Kelly is a retired FBI agent and crisis negotiator. And honestly, some of the conversations, some of the stories that she has are absolutely unbelievable. In this podcast, Michelle is going to teach you how to bring the elite level listing skills that hostage negotiators use and implement that in your corporate life. And honestly, some of the lessons that she taught me about listening and about communication in general kind of blew me away. So I really think that you're going to take away a ton of stuff from this podcast. This is the Into the Mind podcast, and my name is Harrison Brown. Without further ado, enjoy. Something that really stood out to me as being quite incredibly interesting is the hostage negotiation kind of tactics. What kind of training do they give you for the hostage negotiation?
Well, I think the training is great. You know, all of the training I went through at Quantico, the training I went through with the Metropolitan Police Scotland Yard was excellent. It's putting those skills into practice and recognizing what works. Especially, you know, I think Metropolitan Police Scotland Yard and the SAS are excellent. They take what worked, they look at their successes, and they build upon those. They don't look back at what didn't work. They focus on what worked and continue to build it and make it better. And I think as hostage negotiators, you take those skills that worked. And there's probably about five of them, five core skills that we really focus on that work. And again, they're skills that we all have. I use the analogy of, if you've ever rearranged things in your kitchen or even in your bathroom, something that you use every single day, and say you've moved the trash can. You've moved the trash can from one side of the room to the other side of the room because it looked better. You know, you added more furniture. You've done something. So you move something that you use every single day to a different spot. Wow. So think about it. If you've moved your trash can, what happens the first time you go to use it? It go to throw something away. You go to the spot where it went, right? And you're like, ugh. So then you start going to the new spot. And that's exactly what we teach with listening. Is you're going to move in the trash can. You have the skills, you know what they're all about, but you've got to consciously think about them to put them into practice to make yourself great. And what, you know, like I said, there's some core skills that we use. We talk about mindsets, but one of the biggest ones is to use questions sparingly. We all think if we ask questions, we're going to get all of this information and that's a good thing. And it's actually just the opposite. Because when you ask questions, one, you reveal what your agenda is. Second, you change the subject. And again, think about when you have a conversation with your best friend or your spouse or someone who is important to you, and they're telling you a story about something bad or something great that's really happened. And you listen, you just sit back and you listen. You're not asking questions. You're not peppering them with questions to get more information because you want to hear the story, right? Mm-hmm. And so we say use questions sparingly. Use one good open-ended question that you can start to get information, which you can then turn into intelligence. And when you start to use those, when you ask that one question, people will talk. And you want people to relax. When people are relaxed, they talk a lot. And for us as hostage negotiators, that's great because the secrets are in the rambling. They will disclose so much information that's going to help you when you get to that stage where you want to propose, hey, you know what? Sounds like you're having a really bad day. Why don't you come down off the bridge? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's those sorts of things that you use in your proposal to get to influence them, to understand them, to get them to do what you want them to do. Questions also are, we use them to our benefit, because if the person is asking you questions, it tells you exactly where they see the benefit and what they want to accomplish and what's important to them, their values, their motivators, their beliefs. So you also say the clues are in the questions. So the secrets are in the ramblings, and then the clues are in the questions. We often, when we do the corporate training, for the folks that go into meetings, we always say go in pairs. One person does the talking, and then the second person write down every single question the people in that meeting asked, because you're going to know exactly where they see the benefit, where they are motivated, where their values, and their values and beliefs are. It's an extremely powerful tool. In fact, I challenge you, when we get done with this, the next conversation you have, listen to the questions that somebody asks you, and you're going to say, this is what you want to talk about today.
is there any way of camouflaging that? Is there any way of kind of avoiding someone detecting exactly what you're after through the questions you ask?
I don't think so, because people are asking questions to get information. But when you sit back and listen, when you ask that one good question, or you use those questions sparingly, you're going to get information, and they're going to tell you a lot. And you have to discern or figure out which pieces you can use for your agenda to influence them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And I've heard of this process called mirroring in another mm-hmm. podcast that I've done. And I actually found it really interesting. And I started using it on my missus. And it actually works a lot better than you would think. Can you kind of describe the process of mirroring and why it's effective?
So again, it's a title to something that you do that subconsciously. Like I said, when you're having a conversation with somebody and you're truly listening, you do it subconsciously. But in your case, you've given it conscious thought and recognize that it actually works. And the reason why it works is because it keeps the person talking, right? She continues to talk about something that's important to her, correct?
Yeah.
Yes. And you're not changing the subject. Right? You're repeating back those last few words. You might be put a little intonation into them when you're having the conversation with her. So, you had a really good time with your girlfriends. Your girlfriends. And you're going to continue down that path again, because you're keeping her on that same topic. You're not changing the subject. And here's a quick example of how changing the subject works. So you come into work on a Monday morning, you see a colleague of yours, and water cooler chat. Hey, how was your weekend? Ugh, my weekend was great. It started off great. And then my in-laws came in. And then, we ended up going to the movies, and you chime in and you say, oh, you went to the movies. When that person, what was troubling them? The in-laws came to town, right? They're like, So they probably want to talk about the in-laws and how horrible the visit was with their in-laws, when you've just changed the subject and now you're going to talk about the movies, right? So do you see how quickly you can change the subject by asking a question? Oh, what movie did you go see? Because now you're now into movies instead of what they want to talk about, which is their crummy visit with their in-laws.
How would you be able to detect that? I mean, if you were in a negotiation situation, how could you detect exactly what they wanted to talk about based on the questions or what they were telling you? Is there any tells that you would kind of aim for?
So it is. It's using those listening skills. It's stop asking questions or using questions sparingly, because when I ask questions, one, I'm going to change the agenda, and second, I'm going to give away what's important to me. And when you're having these types of conversations, you have to remember that it's about them, not you. You're trying to get as much intelligence as you can to craft that proposal that's going to resonate with them. And that's what it's all about. Because if we can persuade or influence, I'm going to take that over negotiation. Because when we negotiate, we have to trade something away. So persuasion and influence is better. And you want to, not better, but persuasion and influence, you want to go with that. And if that doesn't work, then you shift into negotiation. But back to your question of, the tells, or how do you know? When you're having a critical conversation, again, it's about them, not you. And it does. You have to discipline yourself to not ask those questions that you want to ask. You have to discipline yourself to put your opinions and your judgments on the shelf, which probably is one of the more difficult things. But you have to recognize that those opinion and judgments will creep in. And as a negotiator, you recognize you're not having a chat with someone that you met at the coffee shop. You're having a chat with somebody who's either in crisis, who's done something terribly bad. And it's typically not somebody you want to have a chat with, nor do you particularly like that person. But it's that opinion and that judgment that I don't like you, I have to put aside. Because to make sure everybody goes home safe, I need to I need for you to like me so I can influence you.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think it makes total sense. And is there like, have you had any situations when you're doing negotiations where you've kind of like actively used those techniques? Are you allowed to disclose that? Is that kind of like allowed?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because it's, I think, I can't stress enough, subconsciously, we're competent listeners. And we can go back to, if I was to ask you, who taught you how to listen?
Mom and dad.
There you go. And what did they teach you? How did they teach you to listen?
To be quiet.
Right? And it stumps most people, if not all people, because it's one of those skills that you take for granted. We all know how to listen. But again, it's just picking up on those little bits and pieces that make us good listeners. Putting yourself in a listening position, which we call the, you paid how much for that? You're tricking your brain into saying, hey, listen, sharpen up. This is really important. Click in and listen, which is exactly what you do as negotiators. You put yourself in that listening position because you're telling your brain, hey, listen, this is really important and I need to focus so I can be consciously excellent. It goes back to what we say, kind of controlling your emotions. Like I said, this is not your typical chat with somebody at the coffee shop. This is, you're chatting with somebody that has done something terribly bad. And probably the first thing you want to say is some sort of explicative, call them a jerk or something a little bit stronger than that. But you can't, because it's not going to forward the conversation any, right? You want them to like you so you can influence them. And it's controlling those emotions and recognizing what those emotions are and putting yourself in a mindset. You want a mindset like you're going on an adventure. You're going to put that mindset. We're not having an argument here. I don't have much compassion for you, but I'm going to keep an open mind. I'm going to listen to what's brought us here today so that everybody goes home safe. And it's setting that mindset and recognizing those opinions and judgments and those emotions that are going to creep in and prevent you from keeping an open mind to be able to listen for that intelligence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think I can understand the point where obviously you're going to have a lack of compassion for someone that's done something not very nice. Is that been an issue for you in the past where you've kind of been talking to somebody that's done something quite terrible and you're thinking, I'm really struggling with this?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Because you don't like them, but you've set that outcome of, we need to get the hostage out. We need to save lives. There's something that trumps your feelings and emotions. And it's setting that outcome to recognize that what starts to creep in is not going to be helpful to the conversation. And it's sort of, we talk about how it relates into the corporate, to the business world, to the sales world. When you're chatting with somebody and you're trying to sell them something or influence them, they will give you information or intelligence as to, their feelings, their values, their beliefs, their motivators, what makes them tick. And once you tap into their values, beliefs, and motivators, that's where that conversation starts to lead down the path of persuasion and influence, because it's about them, not about you.
So you talk about this persuasion and influence and how that's more effective than negotiation, because negotiation is like you are giving them something in order to get something, whereas persuasion, they will do something for you, I'm kind of gathering. So how, let's say you were like a manager and you were managing a marketing team or a sales team, how could you be more persuasive? How could you use these kind of techniques to allow you to, I don't want to say manipulate because that's not the right word, but kind of mold people into what you want them to be and for them to follow you and trust you?
Right. Well, and I think you hit on a key point there. It's trust. It's trust and likability. When people trust and like you, they will listen to you. And it's building that trust and likability. And how do you do that? You start by having a conversation with folks. Use your questions sparingly and get to know the person. You have to be patient. It's not something, it typically is not something that happens quickly. And it's gathering all of those pieces, the facts, the emotions, the motivators, the values, the characteristics of that person. And you gather those all through conversation. We often say you also have to get clarity, and you don't want to offend somebody. Another skill we use is called stating your impression. And the way this works is you simply state back what you think they're saying. So it's one of those, it sounds to me like you're not happy with this current work environment, or it sounds like you're not happy with the product or the process of creating this product, that we're in charge of. And right there, you're going to get immediate confirmation. You're absolutely right. I'm not happy. And this is why I'm not happy. Or you're going to get confirmation. They're gonna say, nope, that's not it. That's not it at all. I'm completely happy with the project that's going, but I'm not happy working with so and so. So do you see how that, so you're suggesting it in a way that you're not offending the person, because it goes back to that trust and likability. You want them to like you. And how do you get that likability? You don't offend them. So you state your impression. It sounds to me, it seems to me. And again, you're going to get that immediate confirmation of, yep, this is where we're going, or nope, this is not where we're going. And that's critical too in a conversation, because again, you're building that trust and likability. You're being patient. You're gathering that intelligence to be able to figure out what makes that person tick. What is the real root of the problem?
Yeah. And I think that most people are like inherently good and they do want to do well, but it's just having that leader in front of them that can guide them to do that. I think something that I've definitely struggled with through, because I've been in business since I was like 16. So especially when it comes to management, I can be quite short with people, and I know that's an issue with me, and even my missus will say, well, you've just been really short with me, but I won't see that as offensive, whereas other people will take that as really upsetting. And I think that that's probably because I have like a lot on and I'm just trying to get somewhere, but that's probably, I'm guessing, not an effective way to manage people, because they then won't respect you or not trust you.
Right. Well, and again, it's moving the trash can. So And you're already halfway there, because you recognize that you can be short with folks, and it's just changing. It's the changing the way that you phrase that. Instead of being short and maybe just snapping, that's not the right way. It seems to me that we're not on the same page. This is what I expect. What are your expectations? So clarify. It goes back to clarifying, right? And it might take just a little bit more time, but throwing that, it sounds to me, or it seems to me, or it looks like, you're giving them the opportunity to correct you or to get clarity from you as to what your expectations are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It's almost like softening the blow. Like, you're still saying the same thing, but you're adding like a cushion at the front of it so that it doesn't hurt.
Exactly. You're suggesting, right? Mm. You're giving them the opportunity, because everybody wants to be right. And remember, it's about them, not you. So you're giving them the opportunity to get it right. And then you may be surprised too, that there's a misunderstanding. How many times have you walked away from a conversation and you're like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing? But when you state your impression and you say, it sounds to me like da, 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 you get that clarity, you get that understanding. So everybody, you're both on the same page, which again, builds that trust and likability. And trust is a big factor, because you want them to trust and like you. Because if your people trust and like you, they're going to listen to you and they're going to take your suggestions.
Yeah, I know. Where does body language come into this as well? Because I suppose most, at least I've heard this might be wrong, is most communication done through body language and not actually talking? So like, is there any tells when you read someone's body language that you can tell, they hate me because they're, you know, they've got their arms crossed?
All right, so let's go. First, we're going to tackle body language, and then we'll tackle the tells or however you want to say it.
All right, everybody, let's just take a little break for a second to talk about the sponsors of the podcast. Chisholm Hunter are a luxury retailer that specialize in luxury watches, and they're world renowned for their luxury jewelry. They stock brands like Tag Heuer, Omega, Tudor, Vacheron Constantin, Blancpain, and they're authorized dealers of these watches. Now, something that's really taking over the watch industry at the moment that's really scary is fake watches or counterfeit watches. And it's really important to get them from an authorized retailer. That's how you know that it's safe, that they're real watches. So if you're looking for a luxury watch or a luxury diamond, then head to chismhunter.co.uk. That's chismhunter.co.uk. And when you're there, hit the discount code or type in the discount code CHSUB, that's CHSUB, for a exclusive 10% off selected lines. That's chismhunter.co.uk with the discount code CHSUB, chismhunter.co.uk. And without further ado, let's get back to this interesting conversation with Michelle.
When we first started our chat, I said that before I joined the FBI, I was a second grade teacher. So I'm going to tell you a quick story about how I went from being a second grade teacher and into the FBI. And when I'm done, I want you to tell me exactly what that story is about. All right, okay. You ready? Okay. Okay. How did I go from being a second grade teacher to an FBI agent?
I'm going to say you didn't like school very much. And was it something like that?
It was body language. You should be able to tell me exactly what that story is about. No, you can't, can you?
Nah, I can't do it.
Nope. So body language is tricky. Yes, you can use it. Yes, it tells you something's wrong, something's good, something's bad. But you're guessing, right? You're guessing. You have no idea what that story was about. Now, if I tell you the story and I actually add words to my body language, you're going to find out that I had a student in my class who on most days was a great student. One particular day, climbed a tree, refused to come out of the tree. So I went inside, called his mom and told his mother that she needed to come to school and get him out of the tree, which she did. And then after she got him out of the tree, she told me I was a terrible, terrible teacher and I should not be teaching. So I questioned myself and got online to see what I could do as a second grade teacher. And believe it or not, FBI special agent came up and I applied, and that was the end of that story. But now you know exactly what it was, right? So you can rely on body. You don't rely on body language, but use it. Use it to state your impression. And like you said, if you cross your arms, state your impression. Looks like you're really frustrated today, right? So you can use it to speculate, to throw something out there, and you're going to get that confirmation. They're going to say, nope, not frustrated today. I'm just really angry at so-and-so, because you're not going to believe what they did on the production line, or you're not going to believe how they messed up this project, or something along those lines. So you can use it, but you have to use your spoken words and you have to listen to somebody to actually confirm or deny what they're actually feeling. And then the other piece is, I think there's no specific tells, because again, you're going to state your impression. You're going to take a guess at it. You know, somebody may not be much of a conversationalist, but you pick up on something, a piece of their body language to start that conversation, to get that conversation rolling, to get that clarity and understanding, that likability and trust, right? I do. We also talk a little bit about horns and horns or halo. Have you heard of that?
No.
Well, horns or halo. Oftentimes when you meet somebody or you have a quick conversation with somebody, you have a pit in the front of your brain. And that pit in the front of your brain says to all the pits in the back of your brain, I really like this person, or I really don't like this person. And so for you, if you're in the position where you have to understand, sell, persuade, or influence somebody, it's important that you get that person that you're chatting with, that pit in the front of their brain, to say, hey, I like this person, and tells all those pits in the back of the brain and gives them reasons why they like you. So horns or halo, it happens fairly quickly.
And how long would that take to figure out whether you like, let's say you've got a manager or a boss or even a friend, you're meeting someone new, how long does it take a person to judge if they like or don't like that person?
That's a good question. I don't know. But obviously there are certain things that, goes back to those opinions and judgments, and putting those opinions and judgments on the shelf. Because in my job, I had to have that trust and likability to get to that influence and persuasion stage. And how did I build that trust and likability? I listened. I used questions sparingly. I stated my impression, and I put those opinions and judgments on the shelf. I think it was Socrates that said, "No thought exists in isolation." There's a reason behind the thought that you have or those thoughts that you have, and it's our job to figure out what those thoughts are and how they influence your decisions. Does that make sense?
It does. What do you think are the, like, if I were to make a couple of mistakes when trying to influence someone, what would be the main mistakes people would make?
We make mistakes all the time. And never underestimate the power of a sorry. If you've said something where you do, your emotions get the better of you and you sort of snap or you get short, recognize it and say, hey, I'm really sorry. It seems to me, and you go back to that state, your impression. Because again, a very powerful tool, you're not offending the person. And then, it's a very simple, I'm sorry. It's not a, I'm sorry, but it's just a, hey, I'm really sorry about that. I get the impression that this is what's going on, and, redirect the conversation back to the place that it was.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. I think when you get, this is something that I said to my girlfriend the other night, I sort of said, I'm sorry that you feel that way. And all of a sudden there was an explosion. I thought, right, okay, I've definitely not used the right choice of words here.
Yeah. Maybe it sounds to me like.
Yeah. maybe don't pin that on her. When it comes to influencing people, and there's a very influential figure at the moment that is perhaps quite... He's definitely trending at the moment. I suppose he's trending all the time, but it comes to Donald Trump. And it's very interesting in the way in which he has influenced people, even though he has like some really outrageous comments, like they're eating the dogs and they're eating the cats. How, like, as a previous FBI agent, what would be your take on Donald Trump, on his strategies of, I don't want to say negotiation, but maybe influence? Mm-hmm.
Oh gosh, that's a whole nother podcast. I think it's a tricky one. But you're absolutely right. He has some sort of influence over folks. It may go back to that pit in the front of the brain. He's put himself in a position where that pit in the front of the brain says, I like this guy, I like this guy, I like this guy. And so they move away from the crazy comments or statements that they hear. And they somehow rationalize them. For me, that it's a good question. But there's a lot of, that gets into your opinions. And it's a good question because you're going to find out values and beliefs when you start to talk about that kind of, that particular question with regards to politics. But yeah, it's a good question as far as, you know, influence, how influence goes, but it goes back to, you know, trust and likability. There's a likability that he has established that folks are willing to overlook some of the shortcomings or comments that have been made.
Yeah, I know. I would agree. It's obviously a very hot area to touch. I think it confuses me in a way. I think that having a strong figure can definitely influence a lot of people, right? Somebody that knows where they want to go, knows how to get there, and is aiming for it. However, what I can't really wrap my head around is, from my view, the reason from, you know, and I obviously don't vote, I'm from the UK, but the reason that I can see that he wants to get into the presidency is so that he can exonerate himself. So like, I find it quite strange that the American people that isn't clicking with them. And it's a difficult one, isn't it?
It is. It's going to be very interesting these next couple of weeks, how it all starts, you know, starts to shift this way and shifts back that way. I think it's mindset. We kind of look at it, you know, is it one person? Is it more the political party? There's so many different pieces that play a part in that. How can I relate that to? So you think about, for us, you know, as hostage negotiators or even in the corporate world, when you walk into, you first meet somebody, again, it's that first impression matters. And it's setting the stage for that first impression, you know, doing your homework, researching the company, researching who you're going to have that chat with, to gather as much, I guess, information beforehand that you can, and to have a real clear set goal, setting your outcome as to, you know, when I walk into this meeting and meet this person for the first time, what's my end goal? Usually it's to set up a second meeting. We want to get in there again. And like a hostage negotiator, sometimes, you know, our goals were very small. We just want to figure out, you know, what is the terrorist group that has this individual and who's actually holding him and are they still alive? So it's setting that outcome from the onset to be able to build that trust and likability.
Yeah, for sure. There's kind of two questions that come from that. One of which, I suppose I'll start with the hostage negotiation. Have you ever dealt with any of these terrorist groups when negotiating?
So, like I said in the beginning, the U.S. government works with the families or works with someone who is the sort of the mouthpiece or the speaker or the representative for the family, who's having a chat with these terrorist groups. You know, we rely on our past experience to provide them recommendations as to, you know, how the conversation could or should go forward. And again, it's going back to, you know, use your question sparingly, state your impression, know your outcome for the call. Remember, it's about them, not you at this particular point. So, yeah.
And do you use any techniques when dealing with these, I suppose terrorist groups is what to call them, to extend the time? Like, I know that a lot of people, when they first come on the phone, we've got a hostage, it's, you know, you've got 5 seconds to transfer me 5 million and 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Do you use any techniques to kind of calm them down? Because I suppose at the start, the pressure is just extremely high, or would it just go back to the same techniques that you stated in the start?
You do. You rely on what works. You know, if you've got 5 seconds for $5 million, what's important to them right there? Money, right? Mm. So clearly they want and they need money quickly. But you do. You let them ramble. You let them talk, because you're going to start to uncover more information, intelligence. What's brought us here today? Why do they need money? Why do they need it so quickly? You know, what is, like you said, no single thought exists in isolation. So you need to get beyond the money, Are they in debt? Did they gamble their money away? Did they, you know, what exactly is happening? Did they, you know, has their life just fallen apart? Well, what's happened? And that's where, you know, you start the conversation. They will give you the information that you need to start to craft that proposal, to get that understanding, that and potentially get to that influence and persuasion stage.
Yeah. Through dealing with these people, have you kind of found that a lot of them are actually just, and I suppose, listen, you should never, I'm not condoning kidnapping in any way, but have you found that some of them are actually not bad people, but they're just in an extremely bad situation where they need money and they need it fast?
Yeah. You know, there's so many, not so many, but there's, people do crazy things, when they're under pressure, and when they're in crisis. And I think what we've transferred from our role as a hostage negotiator into the corporate world is to make people comfortable. You know, we talked about the listening position and, you know, how you enter the boardroom and where you sit in the boardroom and, you know, what does that look like? And when people are under pressure, they think. We want people to relax, because when they're relaxed, they're going to talk more. And they're going, again, the secrets are in the ramblings. They're going to continue to talk. And so when you walk into that meeting and you sit down at a table, you don't want to sit directly across from the person that you're having the conversation with. You kind of want to sit off to the side a little bit. So it gives them the opportunity to look over your shoulder, gives them the opportunity to look away and to think about, you know, to think about and help them relax. Because if you're sitting directly across from them, they don't have anywhere to look. And again, it puts them under pressure. So we call it the 10 and 2 position. Like when you're driving a car, you get your hands at 10 and 2. When you sit down at a table with somebody that you're going to have one of those critical conversations, difficult conversations, so sit a little bit off to the side so they can look away, which relaxes them. And relaxed people talk more.
That's really interesting. I've never thought of that. Because normally I'm just thinking of where I would talk to my team. So normally we'd be pretty much directly, I'd sit directly. So you think that if you just turn that just slightly, they would be more relaxed because they don't have the issue of me staring at them.
Exactly. Yep. At the 10 and 2. Because think about it, nobody likes to be eyeballed. Nobody likes to look, you know what I mean? When you sit across the table, it's uncomfortable. And you know, you're walking into that environment already with a mindset, which is, you know, how is this conversation going to go? And then again, that's going to go back to your outcomes and your mindsets. But when you walk in there, sit at the 10 and 2, a little bit off to the side, so it gives them an opportunity to look away. When you have a casual conversation with a friend, do you sit directly across from them and just talk to them like this the entire time? Okay. Sounds to me. You don't. You know what I mean? You're a little bit more relaxed and you're a little off to the side. Again, one of those things that you do subconsciously, but once you give it conscious thought, it works. You become excellent. So yeah, the next time you walk into the meeting, sit a little bit off to the side, see what happens, and write down all the questions they ask.
Have you heard of some of the differences between men and, I can't remember the study, but I'll put it in the show notes just so people can see it. But there's a difference between the way that men and women communicate. So if you were to look at them at a party, typically the women would be more or less facing each other, whereas the guys would all be at an angle. And there's a thing where gents, especially, not generalizing, but mostly gents, they can't really socialize unless they have something to focus on. Like, so they can't actually talk about how they're feeling unless they have something in front of them that they're building or they're doing or they're fidgeting or they're playing a game. And it seems to be like there's a difference in the mentality between, again, not generalizing, but males and females when it comes to socializing. And that in turn can turn into issues down the line, especially for males, when it comes to sort of depression and anxiety, because they find it more difficult to communicate. Have you heard anything about this through? No,
but that's interesting. That, yeah, I mean, needs something to fidget with to be able. So it's almost like multitasking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They need a game, or they need to play golf, or they need to do a sport. Whereas, like, I would very rarely say to a pal of mine, let's go for a coffee. Whereas I might say, let's go to the climbing gym, or let's go and take photos in Glencoe, or, you know, whereas I know that my girlfriend, she's like, oh, I'm just going on a kind of date with one of the girls, and we're going to get a coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. But again, it's recognizing, you know, recognizing how you listen best. And, you know, if you are walking into a critical meeting and having a critical discussion, recognizing what's going to put you at ease to be able to focus and listen to what the other person is saying to you, it's important. We do talk about, when we would go through our negotiation training, there was always a debate over who takes the notes and how does the note taking take place. And that was part of it. Some people, and you recognized how you listened best. Some people did. Some people had to have, a pen and paper in hand just to jot down a few key words or key phrases or something. But that's what kept them focused on the conversation. And some people just, found their listening position and stayed there. So again, it's recognizing how you listen, giving it conscious thought, again, to become excellent at it. And does it mean because you either take notes or you fidget with something, it makes you a little bit different? You know what I mean? It makes you a worse listener. That's not the case. But again, if that is your listening position, if you were to walk into a difficult conversation, again, just recognize what that looks like. And also take into consideration how it's going to be perceived, but be able to explain, is this going to be distracting to you? Again, stating your impression without offending. So
do you do any kind of like personality profiling of people?
We don't. That's another division of, kind of some of the pieces of what the FBI does. For us, I think it would be similar to your body language, because you're guessing. Stating your impression is such a powerful tool, because you get that immediate confirmation that says, yep, you're on the right track, or no, you're not on the right track. And again, if you're relying solely on body language or solely on personality traits or whatever, you're guessing. And you don't want to guess, because guessing leads to misunderstandings, which leads to lack of clarity, which leads to distrust. And, it breaks down the conversation. So again, stating your impression and getting that seems to me, it sounds to me, it looks like, getting that clarity is key to the likability and trust, because people want to be understood.
So if you were to go into a business with your business partner at the moment, what exactly would it be that you do?
So what we do is we're going to teach you how to listen. Because like you said, when you ask folks who taught you to listen, and then you say, hey, teach me to listen, they're like, oh, I'm not really quite sure how to do that. So we're going to teach you how to listen, and we're going to teach you what to listen for. And I think what to listen for is the key, because you're oftentimes listening for facts and emotions, which are quick and easy to identify. It's the values, beliefs, and motivators and characteristics of the person that are important. And how do you get to those values, beliefs, and motivators? We get there by not asking, using questions sparingly, stating your impression, building that trust and likability. Because once you get that trust and likability, they're going to tell you things, and they're going to disclose what their values and beliefs are. And once they disclose what those values and beliefs are, then you can use those values and beliefs to craft your proposal, because it's going to resonate with them. It has to resonate with them to be able to get to that persuasion and influence. And if it doesn't resonate with them, again, you're going to go back to state your impression. Nope, that's not really what I was looking for. and it gives you an opportunity to go back. All right, let me go back to this. Earlier you said da 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 da. Yep. That's what I said. And you're going to gather a little bit more intelligence and then put it back in the proposal again and submit that proposal again. So with the Listening Institute, that's what we do. We're going to teach you how to listen, what to listen for, how to set your outcome when you walk into those difficult conversations. How do you use questions sparingly? How do you state your impression? And then you're going to come into that proposal piece, which is where my other colleague, Katie Bleach, comes in. And she's amazing. And she's spot on with some, you know, creating, drafting a proposal based on all the intelligence that we've crafted. And then we come back and you pitch the proposal. And hopefully persuasion and influence worked. And if it didn't, then we got to slide into negotiation where we then start to talk about our tradables.
And what would be a tradable? Do you mean in terms of like a negotiation in terms of maybe a pay rise or like what would be the tradable?
So tradables typically would be the quality of the product, quantity of the product, delivery of the product, and obviously quality, quantity, delivery, and, you know, price. And it doesn't have to fit in those four categories, but once you enter into a negotiation, you have to be aware of what your tradables are and you have to be clear on, you know, what you're willing to negotiate with, and, you know, what you're willing to walk away from. So it's a little bit, you know, negotiation is a little bit trickier. I shouldn't say trickier, but, you know, if you can't persuade and influence, then you move into negotiation. Because like I said earlier, if you've got somebody on a bridge who's willing to end their life, it's your job that day to influence them and persuade them into believing that today life is better than death, which they are currently believing that death is better than life on that particular day. And again, it's persuasion and influence because you can't say to that person on the bridge, can you give me your right arm and the rest of you can go over? You know, there's not much that you can negotiate with there other than, you know, persuading them to believe that today life is better than death.
And how would you start that? I think it's incredibly sad when people get to that point where they truly believe that, you know, they're in so much pain that they genuinely think that's the best way to go. That's the best way out. How would you start convincing them to kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel if they were standing on the edge of that bridge? What would be your kind of ports of call that you would go to? Is it bringing up family? Is it bringing up memories they might be fond of? Like, where would you go from there?
So again, it all goes back to what's important to them. Something has happened. Something has brought them to that bridge. Something is so terrible in their life. And we have to figure out what it is. We can't guess, again, those opinions and judgments because, you know, it could be that their family is falling apart and that's why they're there. But it's following their agenda and following their lead to get them to talk about what's brought them there. And once they start to talk about why they are there, again, it's taking those values and beliefs and motivators to say, you mentioned your family is really important to you. And, you know, they're going to, you know, again, they're going to tell you, they're going to ask you, they're going to tell you what brought them there to that bridge that day. So.
I think we were speaking to an ex-gambling addict on the podcast, I think, 2 weeks ago, and he describes this kind of 12 years of spiraling out of control and the gambling addiction. And then he describes the moment when he actually ended up telling somebody that he had an issue and that he was going to end his life. Fortunately, he didn't. And he kind of talked about the relief that he had when he actually eventually talked to someone about it. So I think a lot of people in these positions, they do want someone to talk to, but they feel so much shame that they can't bring themselves to do it. So do you think, in an essence, it's your way to kind of try and, you know, hit that spot that relieves that pressure and allows them to speak?
That's actually a good way of describing it. I think one of people want to be understood. People want to you know, they want to be understood. They want to be right. They want to be able to articulate their story. And, you know, whether you're in the corporate world, whether you are in a position where, you know, you're ready to take your own life, people want to be understood. And it's, again, going back to using those listening skills to get that understanding and that clarity of, you know, where does this person perceive this going, sort of thing, where, again, you know, no one thought exists in isolation. You know, it's like an iceberg. There's so much underneath it that you have to uncover or that you have to attempt to get to. And you do that by listening. You do that, again, by using questions sparingly, stating your impression, building that trust, building that likability to get them to reveal what's important to them.
And is there an issue now when it comes to, when I think about listening and I think about what people listen to, a lot of it comes back to social media and a lot of it comes back to, you know, TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and even podcasts. You know, people are talking to a lot or are listening to a lot of that with huge influential figures. Do you see an issue now where people are listening to the wrong sources and like kind of being molded into something that they aren't because of what they are digesting from social media?
Gosh, that's a good question too. You know, I think it's, I guess it depends. You know, that's out of my wheelhouse a little bit. But, you know, people are influenced by different things. And, you know, if the person that you are having that chat with is influenced by those sorts of things, again, it's uncovering that and it's determining why they have that thought. You know, why are we what is feeding this thought of, you know, whatever you want to be or what you see, and having that understanding and getting the clarity as to why is this happening the way that it's happening. So,
yeah, I think of the presidential campaign is a perfect example of that, actually, about, you know, the every party now utilizes social media. I mean, even in the UK, and it's just really odd because it was never like, I feel like people nowadays have less of their own opinions because they're being molded by someone else's opinions. Like I speak to so many people and they'll just regurgitate something that like Joe Rogan, the famous podcaster, has said. And I'm like, well, that's not your opinion. That's his opinion that you have taken as your own because you don't know the subject. So like it's like a really weird point that we're at, that people won't research, but they'll ingest this stuff that's going on in TikTok, Instagram, YouTube and all that kind of stuff. And that will then mold their opinions. So like as a society, we're a lot more fragile now because we are so easily influenced by social media.
Yeah. It's a powerful tool. And again, they've tapped into those values and beliefs and motivators for that person to be able to identify with that. But I think you've also uncovered a piece where if you dive a little bit deeper into, you know, why they're influenced by that or why they're following that or why they're regurgitating that's, you know, that sort of either rhetoric or phrase, you're uncovering a little bit more about that person. So does that make sense?
It does. I just find it really, I find it interesting what people kind of listen to and why they listen to it. Because like when I was young, my mom and dad would say, you know, don't drink alcohol, don't do drugs, it's really stupid. And I would say, go away, I know exactly what I want to do. And then I'd go and drink. And then, you know, I turned 27 yesterday and I'm thinking, they were actually right the whole time. I don't know why I didn't listen to them. Like, is there a point, like, is there a reason why as people we kind of, I can't think of the word, but we kind of bump heads with our parents, with our siblings, or people that are trying to help us?
I think it kind of goes back to human nature because there's a point where people don't like to be wrong. People want to be right. And I think that plays a part in it. No, I'm right. I'm right. And then you experience a little bit of it and you're like, oh, was it right? but I think that plays a big role in it. And from our perspective, again, it goes back to that suggest, don't ask, you know, don't offend, because people do want to be right. But if you ask, you know, it sounds to me like you think this is a good idea. You know, is it, do you have a deeper conversation to determine why you believe this is so right? And it's much more difficult with your kids than it is in the boardroom.
Yeah, I think so. I also think that you mentioned something really quite interesting earlier about the position of people when they're in the boardroom or when they're talking to a colleague. Is there a specific order that you should speak in when you're in the boardroom? I remember, I think it was Elon Musk or potentially it was Richard Branson. He was saying when he is in the boardroom, he always speaks last because he knows that he will influence others' decision being the senior member. Is there an order in which you should speak?
I think that's all your personal preference. And it's funny because you just go back to your influence by social media. I think it's a powerful tool because what he's doing is he's listening and he's taking note of, you know, either the questions that people are asking to determine where they see the benefits, what their values and beliefs are. I can only speculate. I don't know, but he's listening. He's listening to what all of those other people are saying about a particular product or problem or something that they've come together to have that conversation about. And I think that's key because you're gathering that information and turning it into intelligence to be able to create that proposal, which again is going to resonate with people. I don't know a lot about, you know, speak first, speak last, any of that stuff. What I do know is, you know, ask a good question, that gets the other person talking because it's about them, not you. And you're in a position to sit back, listen, gather that information to turn it into intelligence, to be able to put a proposal together, which is going to influence or persuade. And that's what listening, I've learned about listening. Move the trash can, give it some conscious thought.
Yeah. When you think of your, like just going back to your time in the FBI, did you get allocated a job or like, did you do your own intelligence? Like how did that work?
So typically, like a kidnap or, a person in crisis sort of thing. They would just happen. And then you would get the call. Can you go here? Can you do this? It wasn't something typically that you sought after.
Yeah. It wasn't something that you planned for.
Kind of landed in your lap.
And is there any instances that kind of, I don't know, are you allowed to talk about this kind of stuff? Is that kind of like secretive or are you allowed to talk about the situations that went on in the FBI?
Some of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any that stood out up as kind of above the rest as being particularly, maybe traumatic or crazy?
Yes. I would say probably early in my career, probably mid-2000s, we would travel to Haiti a lot. There were a lot of American missionaries that would go, to bring either families or kids back to the States, for a better life, for medical care, to reunite with other family members. There's multiple different reasons that folks would travel to Haiti. And on one particular case that we worked, it was a missionary who had gone down to bring a little boy, Shelton, back with him, who was a Haitian citizen who had eye cancer. And he was coming back to the States for surgery. And the Haiti kidnaps were typically predictable. It usually happened on a Sunday morning or afternoon. And they would typically last about a week. And the ransomware, the request was always monetary. And this one particular case, we can negotiate on behalf of the American missionary, but we couldn't negotiate for the release of Shelton. And for me, that was very difficult because we didn't know what was going to happen to Shelton once we got the American out. We could only hope that they were going to release both of them, but we couldn't be exactly sure because we couldn't negotiate on behalf of Shelton because he wasn't an American citizen. And I think that was probably, for me, one of the more difficult negotiations because there was a huge unknown. And luckily, they did. They released both the missionary and Shelton at the same time for, you know, a ransom. And Shelton was then brought to the States and had his eye surgery. So it was good. That one had a good ending. But it's typically the unknowns. And we talk about mindsets and outcomes, and it's so important, I think, when you're having a conversation, a difficult conversation or a critical conversation, to have an open mind, to have those opinions and judgments on the shelf, tackle it as if you're going on an adventure, because you never know where it's going to take you, and you never know the information that the person is going to share with you. Like I said, the secrets are in the ramblings. And oftentimes it's those ramblings that give you the intelligence to be able to persuade the other person to do what you want them to do.
Oh, so. Well, that well said at the end there. I quite like that. I'm going to use that. I think I'm going to use that. I'm not sure if you can go into monetary figures or at least exact figures. How big a ransom do most of these people get at the end of, like, versus request? I mean, when you talk about like a business deal, there might be a figure of I want 1 million for my business, but they end up selling it for $500,000. Like, is it the same kind of thing? You kind of negotiate them down, or like, is it more of a, well, we're not going to pay you, so release them? Or like, how much did they get paid?
You know, I don't remember the ransom amount, but it's also tapping into other pieces. It's tapping into the motivation, which obviously motivation for them was monetary, but there are other pieces to it as well. And another piece of that was their reputation, and out in the community, what that looked like. You've kidnapped, you know, a missionary who's bringing a Haitian boy back to the States for eye surgery. And we leverage that because that's the reputation. You know what? As of right now, you have a really good reputation as kidnapper. You know, this little boy doesn't come out. You know, you don't release this American and it's going to hurt your reputation. You know, you're hindering somebody within your own community. But you only get there by recognizing, you know, you're going beyond what motivates them, which was the monetary piece of it. But everybody has values and beliefs, and tapping into those values and beliefs and bringing those to their attention, you know, saying to them, you know, if this was your son that was coming to the States, how would you feel, you know, how would you feel about that? So it's uncovering multiple layers to be able to recognize what's important to them so you can craft that proposal to get them to buy into it, so you can influence and persuade. And obviously in this particular case, there was a negotiation and there was money, you know, there was, I think there was money that changed hands. We might've been one of those ones where we did pull the reputation card and they were like, oh, Jesus, this doesn't look good for us. Here you go. But you know, again, it's uncovering not just the motivation, but the values and beliefs behind that motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there ever, I mean, thank God that the child was safe there and they got back to the US for surgery. Is there any ever, or I suppose there are, but have you got any instances of situations or hostage negotiations that have gone wrong?
Of course. You know, there's always, I think in the overseas kidnappings, it goes back to mindset, and you have to keep an open mindset. You know, there's different motivators, you know, there's money, there's political, and then there's different outcomes. You know, you get a release with a ransom or, you know, some sort of political advantage. You have a tactical rescue, or they kill them. And, you know, again, it's just keeping an open mind, because you can't back yourself into a corner saying, you know, we're going to get them out with money. We're going to get them out with money, when that may not be, the other side's outcome. So it's really, it's keeping an open mind. And again, recovering or uncovering what those motivations are.
It must be quite difficult. I mean, especially, I'm guessing that some of these negotiations can go on for, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but can they go on for kind of weeks and...
Months, years.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They can span on that long?
Yep. They can.
Wow. Right. Okay. And that must be quite difficult. I mean, if you're dealing, I didn't realize it would be that long. But if you're dealing with somebody, let's say somebody's been kidnapped and you're dealing with them for like a year, and then you don't get the outcome that was, you know, the hopeful, the let's say, unfortunately, something did happen to them, you don't get the outcome that you want. I mean, that must be quite difficult, especially if you're the operator on the scene.
It is. But again, I think we talked earlier about, you know, you had the gentleman who was the gambling addict, and talking about it. And I think that's the important piece of it, is you know, you work as a team, and you recognize those emotions, and you know, it does, it takes a toll on you, because it's a different lifestyle. You know, you come from, you know, just a different type of environment than what you know what you're actually dealing with. And to be able, you know, you work as a team, and you chat about what's bothering you, and you know, how the chats are going, and, you know, whether there's threats of violence or things like that. But it's all about having that conversation. We often call it, you know, the negotiation within the negotiation, because you're having this negotiation here, but then you're also having, you know, another negotiation with your colleagues, just to kind of have that emotional piece that supports you to be able to continue down the path that you're going. Yeah.
You said something quite interesting there, and you've said it, I think, three times now, about writing the questions down.
Yes.
Do you think that's the best thing in terms of acquiring, it's spoken like a true FBI agent, but acquiring the intelligence that you need in order to figure out what's motivating them?
I think it's a piece. You know, like I said, there's typically five things. You want to set your outcome for when you walk into that meeting. You know, is it to get a second meeting? What exactly is your outcome? Setting your mindset, keeping your mindset open, you know, tackling it as an adventure. That listening position, you know, putting yourself in that listening position, sitting off a little bit to the side, and actually even leaning in. Because when you lean in, you're tricking your brain to say, hey, listen up, this is really important. And that's a key piece too, because you have to tell your brain that this is important. You know, we referred to it as you paid how much for that? Again, you do it subconsciously, but when you give it conscious thought, what you're doing is your brain is saying, this is really interesting. They got a really good deal. How in the heck did you do this? And you're clicking your brain in, because you want to figure out, how did you get that really good deal? So put yourself in that listening position. And then again, going back to using questions sparingly, because when you ask questions, you change the subject, and you also tell them where you see the benefit and the belief. And you may not be ready to disclose that yet. Listen to the questions that they ask, because the clues are in the questions. When they start to ask questions, they do the same thing. They reveal their agenda, and they tell you where they see the benefit and where they, you know, their beliefs and motivators lie. It's a very strong tool. Try just write down the questions, and you're going to know, okay, this is where this conversation's going, and this is what's important to them. And like I said, it's training your brain to, you're going to want to ask questions, because we're curious. But curiosity is the quickest way, to lose clarity, because you get off topic. Remember, we talked about the movies. So use questions sparingly. And then listening. What are we listening for? Those emotions, values, facts, emotions, values, beliefs, and motivators. And those are key. And you may not get those all in the first conversation. And you can't listen for all five at the same time. So when you set that outcome, say, all right, listen, I just want to get the facts. I want to get the facts of what exactly is going on with this product that we're in charge of producing. What does it look like? You know, how much time is it going to take? Get the facts and then get the emotions that are involved with it. Are people feeling overwhelmed, frustrated? Are they feeling as though this is an easy project and it's beneath them? What exactly are the emotions that are surrounding that particular product? And then once you start to uncover those emotions, you're going to get the values and the beliefs and the motivators. What makes this person tick? Why do they come to work every day? Why is this particular project so important to them? Or why is this particular project, they don't really care about it? And it's using those things to find out what motivates them. So that way you can influence. First, you want to get the clarity. You want to understand what they're telling you. And then you can start your persuasion and influence. And in doing all that, you're going to state your impression because you want them to trust and like you. You want them to listen to you when it comes time for that persuasion piece. So it's all about trust and likability. And how do we do that? We state our impression. Sounds to me like, seems to me, it looks to me. Stating your impression. You're asking questions, you're suggesting something, or you're not asking questions, you're making a suggestion that doesn't offend the other person to build that trust and likability.
Yeah, I'm very with what you're saying. I read, I'll put this in the show notes. I'm definitely going to butcher this stat. So whoever's listening, just read the show notes. It'll be in there. But I believe it's within an interview, if you're interviewing for whatever company you're interviewing for, I believe in the interview, the interviewee, the person that is interviewing, only speaks for 25 to 30% of the interview. And I was reading this and I was thinking, that's so bizarre because surely it should be the interviewer. Like if I was interviewing someone that was wanting to join my team, that would be listening to what they were saying in order to get an idea of what they actually want and what they've done and what they want to achieve. And yes. I think, why do you think that is? Would you just say that people like to talk about themselves?
They do.
Yeah.
Well, and so you bring up an interesting point because it goes back to moving the trash can. Curiosity is the quickest way to lose clarity. Once you start to ask questions, you get off topic, you get off the agenda. When you set your outcome, you're training yourself or you're making yourself follow through and achieve that outcome. So in the interviewer's perspective, he or she is clearly getting off topic. You're not uncovering if this person is going to be a good fit for your business, for your company, you know, for whatever you're interviewing them for. The Listening Institute, we do an 8-hour course. And in that 8-hour course, we talk about those open-ended questions. And how to uncover those values and beliefs. And one of the questions that we use as a training exercise is, tell me about your best boss and why you liked working for them. Mm. So tell me about your best boss. So as the person who's doing the interviewing, am I going to know your best boss?
No.
No. What's going to be important to me? Why did you like working for them? Because why did you like working for them is going to uncover how you like to work. Do you work independently? Do you like to work in a team? Do you need a lot of oversight? That's where I'm going to figure out if you're a good fit for this business or for that company. But you're asking in that open question, tell me about your best boss. Oh, yeah, I worked for so-and-so and we worked on this project together. Why did you like working for them? Well, you know, he kind of let me do my own thing. There wasn't a lot of oversight. We worked independently, but yet we could come together for meetings if we needed to check in. So it's all of those pieces that tell you what motivates them, where they find their beliefs, and where they see the value.
I'm going to steal that.
You should. It's a great, because it is. It's a great question. And, you know, especially in your business, you know, tell me about the best diamond you've ever purchased, or tell me about the best piece of jewelry that you ever purchased. And why is it so important to you? It's why it's so important to you is that's where you're going to uncover those values, beliefs, motivators, characteristics of what makes that person tick.
Do you do this to your friends and to your children? Do you use these techniques?
I do, and they're very, I will say my husband is very wise to my ways now, so I can't really, well, and my son is 12, and so I can't often get away with it with him either. And, you know, he picks up on it fairly quickly. So it's, but it is, and sometimes you can catch them off guard, and they will start to tell you things, and you're like, yes, I got you. No, I used to say that. But it is, it's an extremely powerful tool. But it takes conscious thought, because we're all subconsciously good listeners, but to be an excellent listener, move the trash can. And you do, you have to practice. And you know, the light bulb comes on and you're like, ooh, this conversation is taking a little bit of a different turn. I'm going to sit back. I'm going to listen a little bit, and I'm going to stop asking questions.
Okay. No, it makes sense. That was a really interesting one there, because within that question that you asked that whoever's interviewing, you can legitimately get everything you need to know. And I can't believe I've not thought of that question yet. It seems so simple now.
And I can't take credit for it. That's one of Richard's questions, but it's an extremely powerful question, and you can tailor it, into multiple different facets. You know, again, you can go back to creating a product, and you know, what do you want this product to look like in the end, and how much work do you think you have to put into it? You're going to find a lot about how that person works and operates, and how you're going to achieve that end outcome of what this product actually looks like. But again, it goes back to, it's about them, not you, and it's following their agenda to find out what motivates them to be able to influence and persuade.
So what happens if the roles were reversed? I'm just thinking about, like, so say a member of my team or a member of your team comes up to you and says, you know, I'd like a salary increase. What happens when the roles are reversed? What advice would you give someone that's, let's say, looking for a salary increase and pushing themselves to that next level in the career? What would be the kind of the social implications of that? Because I think that for a lot of people, it can be very scary asking their boss for a promotion or for a pay rise, you know, especially if they're not a confident person, but maybe they are doing a very good job, but they're just not confident in themselves. So what would be your kind of advice to have the confidence and to kind of ask in a non-corrosive way for, let's say, a pay rise or a promotion?
Right. So again, goes back to being patient and that trust and likability, and determining what that position. So if they want, I guess I would start with what's expected out of the position that you currently have, and starting the conversation, you know, potentially with your boss saying, I really enjoy my position here at such and such a company. What are your expectations? You know, how do you foresee this position growing? Or how do you see, what are your expectations of this particular position? Because again, you're going to uncover where they see the value and where they see the benefit. And getting their value and their benefit and being able to articulate it in your proposal is going to resonate with them. So say, what would be a good example? It sounds to me like you value hard work, and you know, you value attention to detail. Am I meeting that expectation, and how can I do that better? And then sort of kind of weave in, you know, it sounds like I'm meeting your expectations and somewhat exceeding your expectations, you know, and phrasing it in a way that you're not offending the person. Would it be appropriate, or it seems to me that somebody who's meeting these expectations or exceeding expectations would also be considered for a pay raise. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. It does.
But first it's determining where your boss or whomever you're having that conversation with sees the value and the benefit. To be able to put that into your proposal, because it's what, how they perceive that. And then tying it into, you know, am I meeting your expectations? And if I'm exceeding those expectations, is it something that would be worthy of a pay raise?
That makes sense. And what happens if it was, I'm going to have to quiz you here. So what happens if you're in a argument in a relationship? If I'm in an argument with my girlfriend, how would you suggest from an FBI's point of view, from a negotiator's point of view, to kind of smooth over that argument and make everyone happy?
Sorry.
Yeah, as easy as that?
I'm just kidding. You know, again, it's a tough one, because what's involved there is emotions, and your emotions and her emotions, and it's recognizing those emotions, and it's not an easy thing to do, to step back and say, it sounds like you're really frustrated. Because oftentimes the woman is always right, and because I think because clearly you're in an argument because there's lack of clarity and there's lack of understanding on both parties' sides. So stepping back and saying, it sounds like you're really frustrated. Can you tell me what you're frustrated about? And it could be something totally different. It could be because you didn't fold the laundry and you're angry because she put your favorite shirt in the dryer and it shrunk two sizes. So, you know, it's getting clarity. And oftentimes, you know, you're over here and she's over here and you're arguing about two different things. But unless you have that conversation, you're not going to know what exactly, you know, are you arguing over the same thing?
Yeah. So it's getting clarity over exactly what you were both frustrated about. And yes, that will allow you to come to a solution, because you can't come to a solution if you're both arguing over different stuff.
Correct.
This is, I promise this is the last off-topic question, but there seems to be this stigma in all movies, and maybe I've watched too many movies, and maybe it's that influence thing that they were talking about before, but between the police department and the FBI, they seem to hate each other. Is that like a real thing, or is that just movies?
I think it's just movies. Okay. Yeah, we work, you know, I wouldn't be able to do my job without our state and local partners. You know, we rely on them heavily. And everybody has different tools that they bring to the table. So you absolutely have to work as a team. So, but yeah, it makes for good drama. And again, even though, you know, you're seeing me here, I am actually 6 feet tall and blonde. So.
And I suppose to cap things off, I know that we're just coming up to our time, but if you were to leave someone within this podcast or that's listening to this podcast with a couple of sneaky hacks, quick bits to become a more effective persuader and a more persuasive influencer, what would you say they were?
My recommendation would be to keep an open mind, you know, be aware of your mindset. Just be aware of questions. Use questions sparingly. Listen to the questions that are asked. Clues are in the questions. And state your impression. Suggest without offending. And get that clarity and get that understanding to build trust and likability to be able to influence and persuade.
Amazing. Well, Michelle, listen, thank you so much. Honestly, you've told me so many things that I'm going to re-listen to this. And I'm going to write them all down. And the interview question specifically, I'm using that 100%.
No, it's been such a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's been a gift for me to be able to share what I've learned and what Richard has taught me. Like I said, what I've learned along the way in my FBI career with folks to make folks better listeners. Because we can all listen. It's just being better at it and giving the people time, giving yourself time, giving the person that you're listening to time to build that trust, that likability, to establish that understanding, to get that clarity. I think folks are happier when they walk away with, this person actually listened to what I had to say. And it's really a simple and small gift that you can give somebody.
Absolutely. And I think everyone can do it. It's not like you can't listen. So it's just, it's something that people kind of know, but they're not doing.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
Move the trash can.
Exactly. And where can people find you? Are you guys on Instagram or are you on any social media, or where could they find you if they want to find you?
A little bit. Yes. So I'm on LinkedIn. Both the Listening Institute and Michelle Kelly are on LinkedIn. We do have an Instagram page, the Listening Institute NA, which is the North American side for the Instagram site. And then the website, listeninginstitute.com.